You're listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadler. Episode 15, Herod the Great. Few stories in the New Testament are as well known and artistically depicted as that of Herod and Salome. According to the account in the Gospel of Matthew, Herod threw a banquet at which his niece, who incidentally the text does not name, but identifies only as the daughter of his brother's wife, danced so delightfully that he promised her anything she wished. Spurred by her mother, whose marriage John had opposed, the girl said, "Give me here on a dish the head of John the Baptist." Despite Herod's misgivings, he did not deny her. As Matthew 14:11 states, the head was brought on a dish and given to the girl, and she carried it to her mother. Perhaps no other story better captures the character of Herod the Great in Western imagination. Oops, wait a minute, wrong Herod. Actually, as Matthew correctly points out, but the parallel account in Mark chapter 6 does not, this is a story about Herod's son, known as Herod Antipas, the tetrarch who ruled from 4 BCE to around 29 CE. Herod the Great was responsible for a great deal of bloodletting, but for at least this one death for which he might be best known, that of John the Baptist, he was entirely innocent. What do we make of Herod the Great? Although the New Testament Gospels deal almost entirely with the time after Herod's death, they do not completely let him off the hook. Matthew chapter 2 tells a story of Herod. This time it really is Herod the Great, hearing of the birth of Jesus. When he was unable to find him, enraged, he ordered that all the male children of Bethlehem shall be put to death. Known as the story of the Massacre of the Innocents, this story is undoubtedly more fiction than fact, intended, as is clear, to prove that Jesus fulfills certain biblical prophecies. Nevertheless, it reflects a less than kind historical memory, one, moreover, that due to the prominence ultimately given to the New Testament, would be burnished in Western history. In this episode, I would like to present a more complex picture of Herod. Herod was indeed a murderous savage. According to a later account, the Roman Emperor Augustus is said to have quipped that it was better to have been Herod's pig than his son. The joke, which, okay, admittedly sounds better in Greek, alludes to the fact that Herod showed sensitivity to Jewish food laws, not eating pork, at least in public, while at the same time he seemed to show little compunction about killing his children. This quip, too, is likely to have been a later invention, but captures both sides of Herod. Herod may have been savage, but he was not indiscriminately so. There was a kind of method to most of his madness. In truth, and when compared against the Hasmoneans whom he usurped, his rule over Judea could be judged to have been quite successful. I'll explain what I mean by this shortly. The New Testament provides little actual historical information about Herod. Similarly, the rabbis, writing some years after the New Testament, were neither fond of Herod nor particularly interested in reporting historical details about him. So that leaves us once again with Josephus, as well as the many material remains of Herod's palaces and building programs. Our use of Josephus is additionally complicated by the fact that he appears to base himself primarily on another secondary source, the court history of Herod, written by a certain Nicolaus of Damascus. Nicolaus was a friend of Herod's, and his history of the court, like that of the author of 1 Maccabees, a history of the early Hasmonean court, was undoubtedly highly biased. Undoubtedly because, unfortunately, an independent copy of Nicolaus's history no longer survives. He is known only through extracts found in other later texts. True to form, Josephus does not actually tell us when he is using Nicolaus and when he is not. But most scholars today think that most of Josephus's account of Herod relies heavily on Nicolaus's earlier work. Herod enters into the public eye around 47 BCE. This was during the reign of Hyrcanus II, whom Josephus depicts more or less as a puppet to his advisor, Antipater. Antipater was an Idumean. Idumea, you may remember, was south of Jerusalem on the western shore of the Dead Sea. And the Idumeans were forcibly converted by John Hyrcanus, Hyrcanus I, around 125 BCE. Antipater appears to have been the son of the strategos, some kind of ruler-governor of Idumea. He was rich and pushed his own agenda aggressively with Hyrcanus II against his brother Aristobulus II. After Julius Caesar's victory over Pompey, Antipater and Hyrcanus quickly moved to support the new ruler of Rome. As a reward, Hyrcanus was confirmed as ethnarch and Antipater as procurator. The precise lines of responsibility are not entirely clear, but Josephus reports that Antipater appointed his eldest son, Phasael, as governor of Jerusalem, and his second son, our Herod, in charge of Galilee. It was in Galilee as a young man, he was either 15 or 25, depending on whom you believe, that Herod first achieved notice. Herod quickly took action against an armed group that might have had political aims or simply have been bandits. The account is again not clear. In any case, Herod enforced order in Galilee ruthlessly, thus earning, again according to his admiring biographer, the respect and admiration of the population. In his zeal for order, Herod went a bit far, or at least far enough to give an opening to his enemies, a theme that would repeat itself in his career. Jewish notables, and Josephus does not give us any more specific information about the identity of these notables, brought charges to Hyrcanus against Antipater and his sons. Hyrcanus summoned Herod to the Sanhedrin for judgment. Between the forces that Herod brought with him as a bodyguard and the letter sent in his support by the Romans, there seemed to be little chance of an actual trial. Herod overplayed his hand, though, and at the urging of a Pharisee named Simeas, outraged by Herod's haughtiness, the Sanhedrin moved to condemn him. Herod, though, quickly escaped to Syria, mustered his forces, and threatened war against Hyrcanus. Dissuaded from actually following through with his threats, Herod bided his time, now as strategos of Coele-Syria, encompassing what we know today as northern Israel and part of Lebanon. Over the next several years, Judea underwent something akin to a low-level civil war. One of Hyrcanus' advisors had Antipater, Herod's father, killed. Herod and his brothers managed, with Roman support, to murder their father's killer. Tensions ran high between Antipater's sons and Hyrcanus II. Rome, in the meantime, vacillated. Herod was an effective ally, but Hyrcanus, after all, had been appointed by the Romans. Herod and Hyrcanus made up under pressure from a common threat. The problem was Antigonus, the son of the defeated Aristobulus II. He achieved some modest military success in the Galilee and Coele-Syria before being beaten back by Herod. Sometime during this period, we are now around 42 BCE, Herod saw the advantage of an alliance with Hyrcanus. Following a normal custom of the day among the ruling class, Herod cemented the alliance through marriage, or more accurately, the promise of marriage. Herod sent away, but appears not to have divorced, his first wife, with whom he had a son. The Bible allowed for polygamy, marriage to more than one woman at a time, and Herod made an agreement to marry Mariam, Hyrcanus' granddaughter. The marriage itself wouldn't take place for another 5 years, but the agreement was sufficient for political purposes. After his defeat of Antigonus, Hyrcanus feted Herod. Herod, much like the early Hasmonean kings, was a shrewd diplomat. Mark Antony took control of the region, and Herod leveraged Antony's support against the group of Jewish notables, again otherwise unnamed and unspecified by Josephus and his source, who continued to oppose him. These same notables most likely joined with the forces of Antigonus, who still harbored royal aspirations. There were daily skirmishes, as Josephus calls them, between the supporters of Antigonus and those of Herod and Phasael, his brother. Hyrcanus II, the lawful ethnarch and high priest, had been reduced again to something of a puppet. Antigonus, though, had a card up his sleeve, support of the Parthians. What began as a series of skirmishes rapidly escalated. The Parthians plotted against Herod, and Herod, with thousands of supporters, was forced to flee back to his native Idumea. Herod's Jewish enemies joined the Parthians in harassing him, but Herod and his group succeeded in beating them off. Hyrcanus and Phasael were not so lucky, though. Antigonus was not quite up to killing his uncle Hyrcanus, so he merely cut off his ears, thus invalidating him from the high priesthood. Phasael was murdered. It is now around 40 BCE, and Herod, leaving most of his supporters in Idumea, went to Rome to plead his case to Antony. Antony was sympathetic, but Herod's case certainly was not hurt, both by a significant bribe and by the fact that Antigonus was colluding with an enemy of Rome. Within a week, the Roman Senate voted to confirm Herod as king of Judea. Now he had to wrest control from Antigonus. The Parthians proved to be fair-weather friends to Antigonus. Having satisfied themselves with plunder, they largely withdrew, leaving Antigonus to fend for himself. Herod returned to Judea, and now with Roman and mounting Jewish support, he quickly took the Galilee, Jaffa, and then lifted the siege of his family at Masada. Antigonus retained only Jerusalem. Herod began his siege of the city. Antigonus bribed the Roman general accompanying Herod, but he must have suspected that the cause was lost. Nevertheless, he made an intriguing argument. Herod, he argues, was a half-Jew, the son of an Idumean, and not a royal blood. Moreover, and here Antigonus continues this line of argument, if his own rule is objectionable to the Romans, it is better to entrust authority to another member of his family than to Herod. There is a principle at stake. The argument was, of course, not effective, but it is worth thinking about for a minute. For one thing, it comes with not a little irony. Antigonus was claiming the prerogatives of royal blood, that of the Hasmoneans. But it was the Hasmoneans who, a bit over a century earlier, had taken the kingship and the high priesthood for themselves, when there were other candidates who had a prima facie better case. The word half-Jew is also of interest. What exactly does this word mean? It does not seem to be a legal designation, but more of a slur based on a widely shared assumption that descent matters. To not be of pure Judean blood is seen here as an impairment. The kicker is that one can argue that as an Idumean, Herod's family had been Jewish for over several generations already. Was Herod a Jew, but not a Judean? To further complicate matters, his mother Cypros was, Josephus tells us, from a distinguished Arab family. Does Antigonus or Josephus then really mean that it is the Idumeans who are, as a people, half-Jews? The issue highlights how fluid identity could be. More importantly, though, we should observe the context. Later historians, relying on Josephus, will call Herod's Jewishness into question. But in this account, it is not most or even a group of Jews who do so. It is only Antigonus, desperately clinging to his throne. There is little in the historical record to suggest that most Jews would not have seen Herod as one of them. Antigonus's fall was inevitable but drawn out. Herod did not want to assault Jerusalem directly, so instead he continued his conquest of enemy strongholds in the area and in Galilee. After a particularly crushing defeat of Antigonus's forces in 37 BCE, Herod marched again on Antigonus, holed up in Jerusalem. It was then, with his forces poised for the final victory at Jerusalem, that Herod decided to marry his betrothed, Miriam. The timing could not have been coincidental or dictated by passion or nagging. Hyrcanus was, for all practical purposes, no longer a threat. Now more sure of his victory over Antigonus, he was solidifying his claims on the kingship. He could now make a claim not only on the basis of Roman support, but also on his marriage into the Hasmonean line. The lengthy betrothal reflected Herod's desire to keep his options open. Should other, more politically expedient matches have presented themselves, I have little doubt that he would have dumped Miriam. To her fortune, or actually, as we shall soon see, her great misfortune, Miriam has now become an important pawn for Herod. Herod's attack on Antigonus was not pretty. Josephus gives two versions of this battle that diverge somewhat, although it is clear that the fall of Jerusalem to Herod and his Roman allies was bloody and involved some destruction of the area around the temple. Less clear is whose fault it was, Herod's or Antigonus's. The result, though, was the same. In 37 BCE, perhaps on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, Jerusalem fell. Despite Antony's previous support of Herod, Herod felt that an additional bribe couldn't hurt, and the Romans put the captured Antigonus to death in Antioch. It is interesting in this regard to note that the Roman historian Dio Cassius, writing in the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries of the Common Era, describes the same event, apparently working from official Roman archives. He writes that the Roman general Gaius Sosius, mentioned also in Josephus, and here I begin to quote, conquered in battle Antigonus, who had put to death the Roman guards that were with him, and reduced him by siege when he took refuge in Jerusalem. The Jews indeed had done much injury to the Romans, but they suffered far more themselves. The first of them to be captured were those who were fighting for the precinct of their God, and then the rest on the day even then called the Day of Saturn. And so excessive were they in their devotion to religion that the first set of prisoners, those who had been captured along with the temple, obtained leave from Sosius when the Day of Saturn came around again, and went up into the temple, and there performed all the customary rites together with the rest of the people. These people Antony entrusted to a certain Herod to govern, but Antigonus he bound to a cross and flogged, a punishment no other king had suffered at the hands of the Romans, and afterwards slew him. The historian remains puzzled and somewhat impressed by the Jewish observance of the Sabbath, called here the Day of Saturn. More important for our purposes here, though, Herod is a kind of afterthought. As large as he looms in Josephus, in Roman eyes, he was just another petty Eastern client of Rome at that time. That was the end of the Hasmonean line of kings, but it was not the end of the Hasmoneans. Hyrcanus II, mutilated and captive now of the Parthians, made his way back to Jerusalem. Miriam's brother, named Aristobulus, was also hanging around. And when Herod appointed a rather undistinguished high priest, Aristobulus' mother, who of course was also Miriam's mother, was outraged. She comes across, in fact, like the mother-in-law from hell. She began to scheme against Herod with some success. She got Herod to remove the high priest he appointed and replace him with her son Aristobulus. Even after that, though, she continued to meddle, sending her own letters to Antony and Cleopatra in Egypt. She and her son moved from being a pain to being a threat to Herod. Herod then had Aristobulus killed. It was made to look like an accident. He then put his own uncle Joseph to death and imprisoned his mother-in-law. This would be just the beginning of his domestic woes. And it was not as if he didn't have other problems on his hands. He first had to deal with Cleopatra's hostility and her own designs on Judea. Just when he achieved some modest success at this, the game changed. Octavian defeated Antony at the Battle of Actium in 31 BCE. Herod, fearing punishment for his support of Antony, panicked and had old, mutilated Hyrcanus killed, fearing that Octavian would restore him to the throne. Herod took a risky strategy with Octavian. Instead of groveling, probably what I would have done had I been in that situation, Herod unblinkingly and frankly told Octavian that he had acted faithfully and with integrity as an ally of Antony, and that, and here was the point, Octavian too could now expect the same from him. Octavian accepted this reasoning and confirmed Herod as king. Again, a large bribe didn't hurt. Herod proved himself a good ally to Octavian. But Josephus tells us, the more he believed himself to be increasingly successful in external affairs, so much the more did he fail in domestic affairs, especially in his marriage. Josephus offers confused accounts of the date when he had his wife Mariam killed, but it was probably sometime between 34 and 29 BCE. The account emphasizes Herod's extreme passion and jealousy for Mariam, as well as the differences in birth and his own mother's and sister's dislike of her. It is by no means unlikely, though, that now that she had helped him gain legitimacy and secure in his reign, she presented more of a threat than an asset. Alexandra, her meddling mother, soon followed her to the grave. According to Josephus, it was now, out of both his burning desire for his dead wife and his regret for having killed her, that Herod began to go mad. Like James Angleton, the notorious CIA counter-espionage agent, he began to see danger everywhere. He began putting friends to death, and the bloodletting within his family would soon resume. But if Herod was mad, it was a compartmentalized kind of madness. In affairs of state, Herod seemed to know what he was doing, even when making mistakes. Herod sought to up the profile of Jerusalem in the Roman world. He invested heavily in building a theater, amphitheater, and hippodrome. Like modern cities that build for the Olympics, the major point seemed to be that these institutions would serve to host international athletic and theatrical competitions. To lure participants, he created lavish trophies. His goal was to put Jerusalem on the map. In so doing, though, he again went too far. The buildings themselves probably caused some grumbles among the more traditional and conservative sectors of the Jerusalem population. The games conducted in these buildings, particularly the gladiator contests, generated more opposition. Completely over the line, though, were the trophies, which depicted humans. Why was this such a problem? According to the Ten Commandments, you shall not make for yourself a sculptured image or any likeness of what is in the heavens above, or on the earth below, or in the waters under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. As usual, there is some interpretive ambiguity in this biblical command. Is one not supposed to make such images only if they are to be worshipped? Or is this a blanket prohibition for fear lest they be worshipped? This interpretive play, if you will, has persisted to the modern day, with Jewish and Christian communities interpreting it stricter or more leniently, depending on their leanings. The Jews of the early Roman period, almost uniformly so far as we can tell, adopted a stricter interpretation. Here we get confirmation from outside of Josephus. Archaeologists have failed to discover a single identifiably Jewish object from the period, aside from coins, that contains a figural representation. Even Herod's coins largely avoided depicting humans. Figural representation was a line in the sand for many of Jerusalem's residents. Herod dealt with the crisis well. He met with the outraged leaders and quickly conceded the trophies. Although the immediate situation was diffused, though, the incident galvanized his enemies around an ideological cause. Now Herod had more to fear than some stragglers from the Hasmonean line. Herod could now be portrayed as an enemy of God, with his overthrow a divine imperative. The upshot of this, a foiled assassination plot, led to a further round of official purging. Yet just when we begin to think that Herod has lost it, he surprises us again. In response to a severe drought, Herod stripped his coins and other treasures to obtain grain to feed the population. According to Josephus, these actions caused Herod's stock among both the people and the neighboring nations, whom he also helped weather the drought, to rise dramatically. Thus begins, around 25 to 24 BCE, the golden years of Herod's reign. With the drought passed, Herod embarked on a massive national building project. Palaces, fortresses, even cities. Strato's Tower, a bit of a hick town at the time, was vastly expanded and renamed Caesarea. More importantly, he paid for the renovation of the temple, beginning around 20 BCE. Herod tells the people, according to Josephus, that the enterprise which I now propose to undertake is the most pious and beautiful one of our time. For this was the temple which our fathers built to the most great God after their return from Babylon. He goes on to describe how he is going to rebuild the temple in order to bring it back to the splendor it had in Solomon's time. When we look today on the remains of the ancient temple in Jerusalem, we are looking at Herod's work. The Kotel, the Wailing or Western Wall, is actually nothing more than the retaining wall constructed by Herod to create an elevated mount upon which the temple stood. That wall, which went down a good 60 feet under the ground of the current plaza, should give us at least an impression of the enormity of the project. Note in passing that Herod understands or positions himself as one of us, with the same ancestral fathers as all of the other Jews. In between this frenetic activity, Herod also found the time to remarry. If this was a classic five-act play, we are now at the climax. Herod has earned the people's goodwill. He took extraordinary measures to care for them during the drought. He increased the fame and prestige of Jerusalem and Judea. He is keeping people employed on public works projects, and he is honoring God by attending to his house. There were, of course, troubles. Who doesn't have them? But Herod had excellent relations with Augustus and seemed to have easily fended off the challenges of some of his neighbors. Family was always Herod's Achilles heel, though. And ultimately, with nine wives and their many children contending for succession, the denouement was protracted and sordid. For reasons of time, I will not go into these battles, other than to indicate that Mariam's sons, Hasmoneans by birth and aggrieved by their father's murder of their mother, were still alive and kicking, and Herod also had an eldest son from his first wife who wanted his just rewards. Herod's sister Salome was no help either. Everyone is plotting, and Herod begins to prune his family, from which he took some time off to deal ruthlessly with a minor rebellion of Pharisees. The Pharisees are portrayed here as a political party with prophetic powers, who refused to take an oath of loyalty to Herod and the Roman government, and then, after Herod fined them, predicted the end of Herod's rule. Herod didn't really like that. It is unclear if this was connected to a later incident around 4 BCE, in which a small group tore down the golden eagle that Herod had placed over the temple gates as a votive offering. Some scholars have taken this as an act implicitly against Rome, but our sources explain it, like the protest against the trophies, as opposition to figural art. Herod obviously had many of these men killed, but he was himself at the end. He died a natural death in 4 BCE, just a few days after having his eldest son killed. He was buried with great fanfare in Herodion. Archaeologists believe that they have found fragments from his tomb there. So what are we to make of Herod? I have gone on just a bit more than I usually do in these episodes, because it is hard to know what we should make of him. His career and accomplishments were so remarkable, but his character so flawed. Herod, quite possibly, put Judea, Jerusalem, and the Jews on the map in a way perhaps not seen since the days of Solomon, if that. He leveraged his alliance with Rome to bring attention to Jerusalem. Those who lived under him, but who were also not related to him, enjoyed some 34 years of relative peace and prosperity under his reign. That's not a shabby record for a lunatic. It should come as no surprise that when it came to dynastic succession, Herod left a mess. Rome ultimately had to step in and take a firmer hand in sorting through the claims of his remaining descendants. I will soon return to pick up the thread of this narrative. But before I do, I want to shuttle back down to Egypt. Philo of Alexandria was Herod's contemporary, although he could hardly have been more different. Easily the most notable Jewish philosopher of antiquity, he has often been portrayed as an accommodationist and the flag bearer for Hellenistic Judaism, that troublesome concept I discussed in the last episode. My students have often found reading Philo boring, but in recent years I've acquired a much better appreciation for him and what he was up to. More on that in the next episode. You have been listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadlow. The original score is by Neil Ginsberg, with vocals by Michelle Tattenbaum. Technical assistance was provided by the Language Resource Center and the Instructional Technology Group, both at Brown University. More information can be found at msatlow.blogspot.com or at mlsatlow.com on the public education page. I welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.